Welcome to the Modern Nutrition Podcast, the show all about education today. I'm Joseph Lyons, and today we're joined by someone who's transforming the way families think about childcare and early education. Rachel Carroll is the founder and CEO of Coral Kids, a company reimagining how parents find trusted, high-quality care that fits modern life. We start our conversation with Rachel's early influences, including her father, a teacher and encouraging parent, before exploring her own education, her perspectives on the UK system compared to her native New Zealand, and the journey of building Coral Kids. We wrap up by looking ahead at what's next for Rachel and her mission to make great childcare accessible to every family. Let's dive in. We'll start with, say, your kind of childhood and upbringing. So your parents were teachers. What difference do you think that made in terms of them as parents and your childhood that they were teachers?
I think it's amazing being the child of teachers. I think it affected me hugely. So for a start, my dad was actually an early years teacher and then became a polytech teacher, so teaching adults. So but I think his heart always lay in teaching the younger kids. And so he was just always teaching, but in a way that I never really realized until I look back on it now. So, you know, everything was always a game, but it always had some purpose to it. He was incredibly encouraging and also quite challenging, but in a really great way. So he was very playful. And so I remember he had this thing he would always say, which was the amazing child. And he would kind of like sportscast, like sports commentator. He was a big, really into sport, really into rugby. This is like New Zealand, everyone's into rugby. Yeah. He's really into rugby. And so whenever I was doing the most minor thing, like, you know, walking along a little fence or something, he would commentate it and he would go, and ladies and gentlemen, we are gathered on this Sunday, sunny Sunday afternoon to watch the amazing child. And the amazing child is going to attempt this feat. Can she do it? I don't think she can do it, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, and you know, the voice of your parent becomes internalized.
Yeah.
And I honestly think being the amazing child has stayed with me, and I have that. I genuinely think I've internalized that that voice,
that kind of self-belief. There's kind of, I can do it. Yes, no, I can. I'm kind of,
I mean, it is something that, like, to be a founder and to be an entrepreneur, you have to have kind of crazy self-belief. You have to be sort of unreasonable about the world in some ways. You have to, because so many startups fail, you have to think you're exceptional. And so it is a thing that I've thought about sometimes. I thought, well, why do I have that self-belief? And honestly, I think it may have been my dad doing that from a really young age.
You must find yourself doing kind of similar things with your kids as well.
Yes, absolutely. But I think my dad did it really instinctively.
Yeah.
And whereas I do it much more sort of deliberately, I kind of think, oh, I've got to remember to do that amazing thing that my dad used to do.
Yeah. Oh, really cool. And in terms of educational expectations, do you think it made a difference that they were teachers to what you wanted to do in education yourself? Because you're such a high achiever. Like, do you think that had something to do with it? Were they kind of challenging you to do the next thing education? Like, you have
actually,
to...
they were never, they were absolutely not tiger parents in any way. There was really very, very, very little expectation on me. And I don't know where, I always had a big drive inside of me to do things. And I've always been very proactive and always wanted to work really hard at school. And I honestly do not know where that came from. It was entirely intrinsic. And maybe that might be part of the answer, that it was never extrinsic. I remember my friends at school who had things like, you know, they might get money for getting an A or something like that.
Yeah,
That was just
I know that.
Completely another world. I mean, there was no way I would, you know, I wouldn't even get an ice cream. Like,
yeah, I think
it was incidental. The joy was already in it. The A was the A. The A was the reward. You know.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it must be like that helps with the kind of not caring what people think as well, because you're not doing it for social validation. You're doing it because it's inside you. So no matter what anyone else says, you're doing it. That's kind of going to be it anyway. And then how do you think, in terms of kind of what's it's like the kind of landscape now educationally for you versus your kids now, what do you think are the big differences to when you were at school versus how they're at school now?
So completely, completely different. So the important difference is that I grew up in New Zealand, and so I'm comparing not only with, like, 30 years ago, but also with a different country. And the New Zealand education system and the British one are very, very different. And there is in a few different ways. Firstly, there is a lot less pressure in New Zealand versus in the UK. And secondly, kids in the UK specialize a lot earlier. So in the UK, you really should start thinking about your A levels, I don't know, when you're 15 or something, right? And then you only do three. And that to me is extreme specialization. And New Zealand is at the opposite end. So I did six subjects in my final year rather than three of high school. I then went to university, and in the UK, you study just one subject. So if you're doing history, you do only history, right? You don't do a bit of history, a bit of science, a bit of maths, a bit of French. Whereas in New Zealand, that's exactly what you can do. So in my degree, to get a degree in something, you only have to do half of your degree actually in that thing. So in other words, if you can get a degree in chemistry and only do 50% chemistry, the other, I think you have to do like 51% chemistry. The other 49% can be music if you want. It could be art. It doesn't even have to be science. It can be literally anything. And what that means is, so that's the other extreme of specialization. And what that means is that when British kids graduate with their undergrad in only 3 years, which ours are 4 years, but you can be like 20 years old, 21 years old, and very, very specialist in a certain thing because you specialize so early. Whereas in New Zealand, you're really not specialist in anything. You've done a very broad range of things. But the other big difference is the amount of pressure. So in the UK, and most countries actually, you have this concept of having to get into a university. You have to apply to get into the university, and that puts a lot of pressure on high school, and then that puts pressure on, you've got to get to the right high school, and then that push pressure on the younger kids, and the pressure just cascades all the way down from this moment of having to get into university. Well, in New Zealand, you don't have to get into university. There's not that concept. It's more like, if you were to say, I'm going to go to the supermarket tonight and I'm going to choose either Tesco or Sainsbury's, you don't have to apply to Tesco to go. You just go there, right? So it's the same in New Zealand. You don't apply to go to university. I mean, technically you fill in a form, you register, but you just go there. You just choose one. And what that means is, because it's very easy to go to any of the universities in New Zealand, that means there's not really any particular pressure on high school. And that means it doesn't really matter which high school you go to. So that takes the pressure off primary school. So just throughout the system, there isn't particularly pressure.
Yeah, so it's like much less like tiered and ranked. I feel like in the UK, you're quite self-aware pretty soon, like even as soon as you hit secondary school, that you're being probably before actually with 11 plus exams and such, that you're being ranked in some way. And
Absolutely.
there's actually so many different ways you're being ranked, like the ranking of your secondary school, the ranking of the university on this table versus this table. Then you're going into a master's program. What's the reputation for this? And it's like almost like it's pretty capitalist, really. You're aligning yourself with as many brands as possible so you can stick those brands to your CV and then be like, oh, I'm smart, and you're constantly trying to prove that you're really smart, I guess.
Exactly. And that system really does not exist in New Zealand. So there isn't a ranking of universities. There isn't a ranking of courses. You can ask around, and different people will like different things, of course, but it just doesn't work like that.
And I guess it sounds like an obvious question, but I guess which is better? It sounds obvious. Like the New Zealand one sounds better, I gotta say.
I mean, I think it is. I think the natural question is, which one? Because the objection to the New Zealand one would be like, oh, well, that sounds great for mental health, but like, why? People have said this to me. They're like, but why would you learn anything if you don't want to, right? And this comes back to intrinsic versus extrinsic. Like, it's kind of a dismal view of education, really, isn't it? That you have to, that the reason you are doing any education is for the extrinsic reward that you get. Whereas in New Zealand, it just is more intrinsic because there isn't the same kind of hoops that you're kind of getting through. And so what that does mean, I do think that means that you have a wider spread of outcomes. because you have people like me who are very intrinsically motivated. And so I did work really hard. And you know, you could say to me, and some kids I went to school with did say to me, "Why are you working so hard?" And it's hard to answer. Because it's not like, oh, because I want to get into a good university. It's like, no, we're all going to go to the same university. Like, I'm getting A pluses, you're getting Cs. We're literally going to the same university. That's how it works. And it was just so you get people like me who do work really hard, and but you get also people who are absolutely able to coast. But you know what? I don't think that we have a worse in New Zealand, a worse economy. I don't think people are like dumber. I'm not sure that I don't think there's much difference in the literacy rate. I mean, I haven't looked it up, but you certainly don't feel that. You don't. There is not an obvious negative that I can see from like having lived half my life in each country.
Yeah, and I guess the kind of it's pretty cynical to be like, why are you doing this education bit or why are you doing this career bit? It's like, oh, to kind of compete, to displace someone else, to get that job so that someone else doesn't, to get that kind of salary that so someone else doesn't. It's a lot about kind of actually just trying to get ahead of someone else. It's very kind of like everybody
That's true. It is. It's like crabs in a bucket, right? You've got to be. You know. You're pushing someone else down. And so, you know, if I reflect on the kids that I was at school with who didn't work that hard because why? Because they didn't, you know, want to. Now I know what they're doing for jobs. You know, and they're fine. They're happy. It's fine. You know.
Definitely. And then kind of moving a bit onto it's kind of both about your approach to your own kids, but also Koro kids in general. I heard that your kind of top value, without knowing it, was courage. And so how do you instill courage not only I guess it must be so hard to separate the two, like what you do with your kids and then what you want for the Koro kids. Like how do you instill courage in your own kids and then by extension how do you make that like policy to like extend that to kind of Koro kids if it's even possible? Maybe that's overextending the service, but you know what I mean.
Do you know, it's so funny because I literally just before this came off a conversation with my most senior product person, and she said she asked me. She was asking me a series of questions for to develop the product strategy, and one of them was, "What do you think we're not doing because we're scared?" And that was a great question. And we talked about a couple of things that maybe we didn't have enough conviction in, or you know, it was a great prompt question. So I think to your second question, we just talk about it. Like, what would we do? You know, what would we do if we weren't scared? What we do? What would we do if we didn't fear the consequences? And then the conversation I was just having with her was, okay, so we named a couple of things, and then we thought, okay, but there's rational fear as well as irrational fear. You know, like a fear of heights, in my opinion, is a very rational fear. If it is rational, right? Like if it's like, don't go out on that ledge because you might fall, like that's a rational fear. If it's don't stand on that piece of perspex, because you know, which is on the top of a skyscraper where you rationally actually know that it is safe, then that's an irrational version of the fear. But there are rational versions of the fear. So I think you talk about the fears explicitly, and you put them on the table. I'm a big fan of just putting things on the table, just like get it all out there, and then look at it. Like take a step back and go, okay, what have we got here? We've got some rational fears as well as some irrational fears, and we talked through those explicitly. Like, okay, so we don't want to do that because we think we're scared of doing that. Okay, but what's the basis for that? Can we actually find reasons that is a rational fear? If not, then it's maybe an irrational fear, and that's how we talk through it. I think with my kids, I do talk about courage, and I think the definition of courage is, I think it's important to frame it as feeling the fear and doing it anyway, as the saying goes. You know, that is courage. And so we talk a lot about that like, you know, you don't have to, sometimes I say to them, you don't have to like it. I'm not asking you to like this. I'm asking you to do it. And that is courage. Courage is when you feel uncomfortable and you do it. And I think there is a modern aversion to feeling discomfort, which I think actually in the moment might make you feel momentarily better, but in a lifetime or in a year and over a longer period of time can make your world very small. And you know, so that's people who suffer from very mild social anxiety, for example, and therefore stop doing some of the things, view the anxiety as the problem, and stop doing the things that cause them anxiety, and thereby create more anxiety about doing those things, and it starts to really grow. And I think we would do better, and this is something that I do talk to my kids about just accepting some discomfort. I talk about deep acceptance quite a lot. I think that's a really important tool to have in your toolbox. And I think we are just the way we talk about mental health these days. Hopefully we're going to get over this as a society, but I think we are right now not into developing tools to combat problems. I think we're really into identifying problems and then doing nothing next.
It's a lot
We
of
need to have
labeling.
more tools.
I think that was really, actually, like, that would kind of stick me really. You labeling, okay, the anxiety or the kind of fear itself, there's no, the discomfort is not the problem. The problem is kind of the attitude and like, how can we improve our attitudes? That makes a lot of sense. And it reminds me actually of a quote about like comfort is the poison. If you're too comfortable too much of a time, that's kind of like a poisonous state to be in. You need to be kind of feeling some level of discomfort to keep on growing and living and kind of. Yeah, like keep healthy, I think.
Yeah, it is. It's a bit
100%.
like exercise, isn't it? You don't want to be permanently in discomfort, just like you wouldn't want to be permanently running. Like you need to intersperse between, some comfort and some discomfort.
Yeah, I have a kind of feeling when I go running, it's like this is almost like what illness would feel like because because you're like you're hot and sweaty. This is like what would fever would be like. Like you have this kind of sense that this is kind of almost so discomforting. It's almost like a mild illness. You
That's
almost
exactly it, right? That's how we build muscle, right? When we build muscle, what building muscle is actually tearing the muscle fibers, and then they rebuild stronger. So you've got to oscillate between this building and repairing and stressing.
Yeah, I see it's like kind of I think a lot of people have a kind of forced choice. They're like either I do nothing or I do that thing that's really hard. When actually the choice is more like I do kind of short-term discomfort things regularly, or in the long term, I'm gonna have a real insurmountable issue. Like
Yeah.
that's kind of how I'm trying to see in it. You develop so quickly and so at scale. How do you like have the courage to like trust so many people with your service, like to do as good a job as you would do personally?
Yeah, it's really hard. It's really, really hard. And I think you set up the systems as best you can set them up. And you have to figure out where you can accept things not being quite up to your standard and where you absolutely can't. Because you can't maintain like the high standards necessarily across everything. And they say when you hire people, for example, the first thing you should get rid of is the things that you're bad at. And that's actually pretty easy to hire for those because you don't like those things anyway, you're bad at them. And then you get rid of the things that the person who you're hiring can do equally as well as you. And the really tough one is when you have to get rid of the things that when you really start scaling very fast and you have to get rid of the things that actually you're really, really good at. And then the trick is to get big enough as quick enough so that you can go through that horrible bit and you get to the incredible bit where you get to hire people who are much better than you, even at the things that you're good at. And that's where it's kind of really magical. But I'm not going to pretend it's easy. It's very hard.
Yeah, who are like teaching you things as well, like as the founder, like,
Yeah,
oh,
absolutely.
is that a better way to do that?
Yes, and I love that. Absolutely love it.
And I know it's kind of what you were like at I know it's Lloyd Pharmacy now, but you were saying you brought marketing to it. You kind of developed their like marketing function. And now I
Yes.
suppose in your position, you'd want to be hiring people who are coming to you and saying, this is the cutting edge of HR, marketing, operations,
Yes.
whatever.
Yeah,
Got it.
exactly.
And and your service at the moment, it's after school and it's also like full day. I'm only wanting to ask about childminders because my mum's a
Oh,
childminder.
amazing.
So I would like grow up around so seven siblings and then there'd also be loads of childminding kids everywhere. And I actually think your service would have been really useful to her because she struggles to, I would say, kind of manage the business side of things. And then I think Cora Kids manages the business side of things for a lot of childcare providers. Is there anything out of interest, my only personal interest, very selfishly, stopping you from doing the childminding as a kind of function?
We did actually do it for a couple of years, and sadly we had to shut that down because we couldn't make it work commercially. But there is another outfit out there that is doing it very, very well. So I could highly recommend them. They're called Tiny. And she should, if she's still doing this, look them up. It's really interesting. I think how little innovation there is in childcare.
Yeah.
And it is kind of disappointing, actually. I would love to see more people doing interesting things.
Yeah, I just think it's a kind of what do you think is a kind of you called it, I think I've heard you use the phrase mental block before. What's like the mental block on entrepreneurs, founders disrupting that industry? I've got an answer myself. I kind of don't want to say it, but I do feel like,
Oh, I want to know your answer. What do you
oh,
think?
I don't, I think it's like because there's traditionally lots of male founders and males don't think to do childcare innovation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a large part of it. Really large. I think it's also just very, very hard.
Yeah.
And it's a multifaceted problem. We've been going for 9 years, and we're only just now reaching the scale that I was kind of dreaming of. And so it's been a long, long, long road. And it took us 3 years just to build the supply. Like it's very, very hard. And it is surprising that we don't have a direct competitor, and it is surprising that there's not more people doing more in this space. But actually, I think this is true. I'm the only of the very small number of startups that are in this space, I'm the only female founder. The others are actually all men. So I think there might be something in that.
Okay. And with kind of what's next, I suppose. So I heard you might be interested in getting into education stuff. That might not be the plan anymore, but what would be next as a service for Coro Kids?
So we're working on some service extensions, which will allow people to use our nannies in sort of different ways, which it should hopefully be available this year. We're not quite sure. And we're also interested in thinking about going international as well. And that would be a huge big thing for us because we're right now in London and we're also throughout the UK, but we're not available outside the UK at the moment. But I get messages constantly from people, like literally probably, I don't know, twice a week, I would say, from people for years saying,
Yeah.
can you please open in my country? Can you please open in my country?
Yeah, and I imagine lots of like asked to do kind of international placements as well, kind of like traveling nannies.
I mean, that would be pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I can
That's
kind of
actually a great
imagine.
idea. We haven't been
Because
thinking about
we've
that.
had the case before about traveling tutors, where like the tutor kind of
Cool.
stays in and then just does the teaching bit.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more rare, of course, as you might
Yeah.
imagine, but it does happen definitely. And yeah, in terms of kind of, I guess, suppose last questions, I'm kind of mindful of the time as well. In terms of kind of what, maybe you've covered this already, but if Coro Kids had unlimited resources, unlimited supply, what would they do? And is that any different to what you'd do if you're in the kind of political position to kind of change the law tomorrow?
I think there needs to be more funding to childcare in general, and in particular, I think after school is really neglected. I think that there's an obsession with making it based in schools, which for a lot of children is not the right thing. There's a lot of children, particularly children with special educational needs, which is a hugely growing and very difficult to serve part of the population. And so I would move away from the obsession with delivering childcare services through schools and after school clubs, and I would fund it more.
Perfect. All right, well, thank you so much for your time.
That was really fun. Thank you so much.
That's all for today's episode of the More Nutrition Podcast. A huge thank you to Rachel Carroll for her time. I'm Joseph, and I'll see you next time as we continue exploring the ideas shaping the future of learning and beyond.